This is an interview with Mr. William G. Addington for the Youngstown State University Oral History Project by David Arms at Mr. Addington's office, 30 South Main Street, Poland, Ohio, at approximately 7:15 p.m. on March 6, 1976. Mr. Addington, could we start this interview with you giving me a little bit of a background of your personal history?
Is this for the...
Right. I mean,
for the military or...
No, your personal. Were you born, brought up, where, when, how?
I was born in Griffin, Georgia, in April 10th, 1921. We came to Youngstown in 1935 due to the Depression. We came up here looking for... to work in the North because of the Depression had wiped my father's business out in the knitting mills. I finished up at the Princeton Junior High School, and I went to South High School, graduating in June of 1939. Prior to that time, I became interested in flying. I spent my weekends up at the Sidner Airport on the old Glenwood Avenue extension, wiping off airplanes, doing all sorts of odd jobs for nothing just to get a free ride now and then. In due time, I was given the honor of flying with a chap by the name of Clarence Chamberlain, who was here with a Ford tri-motor. The bug became worse, and I spent more time at Sidner's Airport, eventually getting my license there after 4 hours solo time. 1941, I enlisted in the Army Air Corps in Columbus, Ohio, sent to Shepherd Field, Texas, where I was processed for flight school, wound up at Las Vegas, Nevada, Tucson, Arizona, Shepherd Field, Texas, Salt Lake City, and Pueblo, Colorado. In Pueblo, Colorado, I was assigned to the 308th Bombardment Group, Heavy, which was a B-24 bomber outfit. We departed in 1943 for an unknown destination, which in 30 days' time wound up to be the theater of China.
How did you get there?
We had our planes flown over by the ferry command. We went by the USS West Point, and the reason for that was it was supposed to be a top secret operation. They didn't want the Japs to know we were coming, so they took our planes over by way of Africa, and we went over by way of the Pacific Ocean up through India, Burma, and into China. We were the only heavy bomber outfit in the China theater because Chenault was strictly a fighter man, but due to the operations we needed to hit the South China Sea, he requested one bomber group, and ours was the one selected for it. Principally, I think, because our commanding officer was a Colonel Eugene Beebe, who was half Barnold's son-in-law, and half Barnold was the commanding officer, commanding general of the Army Air Corps at that time. This enabled Colonel Beebe to make his one-star general. In 6 months, he came back to the States, and we stayed on. The bulk of our job was sea sweeps over the South China Sea, bombing the Jap troops in Burma, hitting Jap air bases, and principally the Jap Navy.
Where were you stationed there? Where was your airport there?
Our main base was at Kunming, China, which was General Chenault's main headquarters. We operated from many forward bases because of the supply problem. Many times we had to put up three airplanes in the air because of lack of parts, using baling wire and everything else to keep us flying.
What was your job now?
As a pilot.
You were a pilot?
Yes.
I see. How about your family life? Were you married at this time?
Yes, I had been married 3 days when I got my orders to return back to base. We had been alerted for overseas shipment. So I didn't even have time for a honeymoon with my young high school sweetheart.
So you ended up in China. What was the time frame there?
We were there from 1940, early 1943 till September of 45. We'd volunteered for a 6 month tour.
I see. How did they extend you? They just said you're extended and that's it?
Well, we went over primarily to open an air route between India and China because the Burma Road had been taken over by the Japs. This was strictly a volunteer outfit. Every man in there was an enlisted man. He was not a draftee. They were all regular Army personnel. They were selected by Colonel Beebe through intensive interviews based on background, education, anything with gung-ho about them. Every one of our squadron COs was a West Point graduate. It was strictly a first-rate military organization. We get over there, the Japs had closed Burma, and they decided, well, there was no chance for us to come back. We couldn't get replacements, so we were stuck.
I see. Now, could you just give me an idea what the living conditions were there in China at the time for you people?
Very poor. When I when I left India and flew over the hump on our first flight into China, it was like going back 2,000 years in the time capsule. The base was a huge grassy field. There was no runway. There was no lights, no sewers, no roads. People there were still using water buffaloes and homemade wooden carts. We went in, we lived in tents for quite a while. And then the Chinese began building mud brick huts with thatched roofs. And that was the basis of our living quarters. Food was consisted mostly of plenty of fresh eggs, water buffalo, cabbage, cauliflower, rice, and whatever else they could bring in. Spam over there was a delicacy in the China Theater, believe it or not. We got spam usually on for Thanksgiving.
Made a nice Thanksgiving. I see. Now, what kind of a plane did you fly out of
this there? This was the Consolidated B-24 Liberator, four-engine, mm-hmm. carried a crew of 10. It was the heavy bomber next to the B-17 Flying Fortress.
So even though you were in the United States Air Force, you basically flew out of China.
Yeah, when we first got there, we were not even considered United States Air Force. We were known as the China Air Task Force.
I see.
We were under the direct command of Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek. We even had Chinese markings on our planes at that time.
But you were still officially in the United States?
United States, yes.
Or Army Air Corps.
Army Air Corps at that time, yeah.
Now, when this was over in 1945, what happened to you then?
Well, when the war was over, I was recuperating from a very bad attack of my third attack of malaria. My outfit had left Kunming, China, and went up to Chongqing at that time. I was left back in a field hospital there to recuperate, and I was the first man from my outfit to be rotated back to the States because I was in Kunming. I was sick, so I was on the first man to come back. I flew over the hump with the British, by the way, in a Lancaster bomber, and I spent 30 days in India waiting for another plane back to the States. So I was the first man to leave my outfit to come back home. So
were you the first one to get here?
No, I wasn't. I got bypassed all the way through. In fact, I got outranked half the way back to the States.
I see. Now, you mentioned flying over the hump. Could you explain what this hump is?
One word. It was terrifying.
I see.
Terrifying. I would rather fly 10 combat missions than one trip over the hump. Probably the worst flying weather in the world. The weather officer could never give you a weather pattern at any one time that you knew you're going to be safe. Uh-huh. I've seen air transport command planes come into our base at Kunming with the wings actually twisted from the elements.
Where is the hump?
The hump is a mountain range. It's the Himalaya Mountains between China, India, Burma, and Nepal.
So the high mountains in there.
Yes. We have lost many, many. In fact, it was called the Aluminum Alley. We lost so many planes over there. They never found the planes or the crews. We sent five of our bombers home on a bond tour with 50 men. They took off from Kunming, China, started across, they disappeared, and we never found them ever since. No word of them, they just disappeared.
What was it, high altitude?
High altitude, bad weather, tremendous winds, mm-hmm. updrafts, downdrafts, the turbulence was just unbelievable.
Unbelievable. Why did you fly over this particular area?
We had a supply problem. With the closing of the Burma Road and the building of the Lido Road, we had to depend solely upon aircraft to bring our supplies in from India.
I see.
And the supplies were limited strictly to war material. So we had to live off the land as far as food went. It was on the reverse lend-lease program. That's why we developed the taste for rice, cabbage, cauliflower, and water buffalo.
I see. Did you know anybody from around the Youngstown area that was over there at the same time?
There was a young man from Youngstown whose name was Frank Soule. Frank is now with the Postal Department, and he was a control tower operator.
I see.
But everybody else was from all over the country.
I see. And you came back to the United States via India, and you finally got back here. Could you just tell me what happened then?
Well, we left Karachi, India in a C-54. There was 30 of us on board the plane. We came by, we left Karachi, we went to Calcutta, to Abadan, Iran, we went into Egypt, the Azores, Newfoundland, and then back into LaGuardia Field, New York.
On the same plane?
Same plane.
How long did that take?
It took us 5 days.
I see. Did you stay overnight at any
particular... We stayed overnight at Cairo, Egypt, and up at Goose Bay in Labrador. We stayed over one night in New York, and we went up into Indiana to a field there where we disembarked and were reassigned here for stateside duty.
What did you do for entertainment overseas?
Well, we played volleyball, we played softball, played cards, we fought. A lot of the guys took up drinking for a hobby. There was nothing to do. Nothing to do. You devised your own entertainment. Boredom was one of our greatest enemy.
Did you have regular mail from the States, or did you have any mail from the States?
Mail was terrible. You might go for weeks, never get a letter, and then it might come in all at one time. My biggest gripe was the V-mail. My wife, who writes small normally, would write the V-mail letter. It would be cut down to the V-mail size. I would take it down to the intelligence department, put it under the map magnifying glass in order to read her letter. And the mail was very poor. Christmas packages were very poor, very undependable.
I see.
And we would never get stuff sometimes for weeks and weeks and weeks at a time.
How was the morale over all of these people?
Morale was excellent. I'm real proud of the American airman, or American soldier, in fact. They had a knack of good humor. They kept things alive. To me, they were tremendous people.
Did you really feel like you were doing something when you were
Yeah,
there?
Very much so. We knew who we were with. We were with General Chenault, who to me was probably one of the most outstanding leaders of World War II. Tremendous man, a great leader. He was not a gung-ho, spit and polish officer, but the kind that you go to hell for. A real gentleman, tough, very shrewd strategist, and really adored by the Chinese people. But we knew what we were fighting there for because we were all aware of Pearl Harbor. I was in Sunday school when the Pearl Harbor attack took place. We knew that it was a matter right now of sink or swim. So we knew why we were there.
I see. Now, you did fly in actual combat, is that correct?
Yes.
Did you ever get shot at?
Oh, yes. We were outnumbered as a rule of 10-1 over there. At that time, the Japanese Air Force was really supreme in the China Theater. They'd been there since 1935. They were very well skilled. They were mostly the Japanese Navy pilots that were stationed in the area.
I see.
They were very fine. They flew the Japanese Zero, which was a superb aircraft, and I think one of the finest aircraft in the world.
Uh-huh. I see. Did you notice a change of the Japanese pilots as the war went on?
For the first year, they were strictly of the samurai type. Dedicated, but then when our air power began picking up, we started hitting the sea lanes and cutting off their navy, their aircraft carriers. There was a deterioration in the number of planes coming over. They'd come over sometimes at the beginning of the war with maybe 60 bombers and 100 and some fighter planes for cover. And as the war went on, we'd get an air raid alert there, but there'd be one bomber with two fighters coming into our base. They were just more or less through harassment tactics.
I see. So you came back to the States and you landed in Indiana. What was your assignment then?
Well, we got sent home for 30 days, delay en route, and then I reported back to Chanute Field in Randtul, Illinois. Mm-hmm. I was assigned up here to the technical school secretary's office. My job there was processing commissioned officers coming back from the States to various jobs at the school or elsewhere in the country.
I see. So how long did you remain there?
I was at Randtul, I would say, about 3 months, uh-huh. And I was released from the service there.
I see. What did you do?
So I came home. I guess being in the routine of being a military man, I was out of uniform for just about 6 months, and I heard rumors that they were going to organize a reserve base up at the Havana Airport. So against my wife's wishes, I went up and looked into the matter and got active in the Youngstown Reserve Air Force Base.
I see. Could you just give me some details of how that came about?
Yes, in 1946, the Reserve Officers Association here in Youngstown decided that Youngstown was an ideal spot for a Reserve Air Force Base. So they sent a directive to Congressman Michael Kerwin, asking Mike for some political assistance in getting this base organized. And of course, Michael Kerwin was a very well-known, prominent politician here, and he generally got what he wanted. And so through Mr. Kerwin's efforts, the base was activated on January 1st, 1947. At that time, was named the 69th Troop Carrier Squadron. Operations at that time were set up in a tent, typical military tent. It was cold, had a grassy runway, very inconvenient. And a Captain Jack Barnhart, who was quite active in the Reserve Officers Association, was named as the coordinator of the recruitment program. At that time, we had some 1,200 flying and ground crew personnel in our area, and Captain Barnhart undertook the job of getting these men interested in the reserve base. At that time, a Major General Thomas G. Hanley, who was the commanding general of the 11th Air Force from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, came to Youngstown and set up the entire plans for the base with the Reserve Officers Association and the Chamber of Commerce. The men that Captain Barnhart had contacted came in from Youngstown, Warren, Salem, Kinsman Alliance, Poland, and Girard, Ohio. And they came in from New Wilmington, Newcastle, Sharon, Sharpsville, Erie, and Grove City, Pennsylvania. So as you can see, these men were here every weekend from all over the tri-state area, practically. A Colonel Charles Bassett, who was commanding officer of the Air Reserve Base in Cleveland, Ohio, came to Youngstown, looked over the situation, and let us have six of his AT-6As, which were advanced trainers, for weekend use at the base. And later on, he let us have two AT-11s, which were a twin-engine trainer, which we also used for weekends. And the unit up there set up one of the finest safety records of any reserve outfit in the country at that time. Mm-hmm. But it was strictly a weekend activity. You were there on Saturday and Sunday, you home at night, and it was just a matter of getting back with the boys for weekend flying, having a good time, and fighting the war over again. Our first commanding officer there was a Lieutenant Colonel James E. Pierce. He was an Air Force veteran from Europe, fantastic flying ace, who was from Irwin, Pennsylvania, which is near Pittsburgh. And he was our first active commanding officer. This man had a face like a bulldog, and yet behind all that facade, he was an accomplished church organist and pianist. We never knew this until he left the area. He was ashamed to admit it, I think, to these wartime veterans. But the unit was officially activated on June of 1947 and was renamed then the 58th Troop Carrier Squadron of the 11th Air Force.
Now this was at Vienna Municipal Airport.
That was the Vienna Municipal Airport, yes. A Major Leo McCarthy, who was then president of the Reserve Officers Association, a Lieutenant Colonel Edward Roberts and Lieutenant Colonel Robert Hammond, both who are now practicing lawyers in Youngstown, were the officials of the Reserve Officers Association who opened up the ceremonies for the activation of the 58th Troop Carrier Squadron. This was done on the back of a flatbed trailer. That's how crude we were at that time. We had much assistance from the 444th Base Unit from Coriopolis, Pennsylvania, the Greater Pittsburgh Airport. They brought in a lot of their equipment to set up with. Mm-hmm. So we actually started with practically nothing. Uh-huh. But the esprit de corps was fantastic. The guys were tremendous, and we grew. Right. As you can see what we have today up here.
Right.
One of the finest bases, I think, in the country for its size. Uh-huh. 1950, some of our units at the base were assigned to the 75th Troop Carrier Squadron at the Greater Pittsburgh Airport, which I was made in the transfer, and then we were activated on October 30th of 1950 for Korean duty. At that time, we were then known as the 75th Troop Carrier Squadron, flying Fairchild C-82 boxcars. And when I came back from that stint of 18 months tour, I was released to civilian life, and my wife let it be known then I would either have my choice of the Air Force or my family. So I had to make my choice of my family, and I more or less discontinued my Air Force career at that particular time.
Well, how many years was that you were in?
I had 4 years World War II. I had 5 years active duty with the reserve unit and 18 months of a recall for the Korean War. I wanted to stay in. They offered me a fantastic deal, but my wife just couldn't see being part of the military. She thought there was just no way for a family to live.
I see. Could you tell me some more about this Korean? What did you do in the Korean conflict?
This was kind of a sad thing. They took our outfit to Greenville, South Carolina.
Now, this was
in 1950.
And you were a reserve officer?
Yes.
Called active duty?
part of that unit, yes.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I got a telegram one evening at 10 o'clock giving me 15 days to clear up all my outside civilian duties, to report to the Greater Pittsburgh Airport, and for active duty for the Korean War. At that time, I was up at the Youngstown College Law School. I had just bought a new home. I had a wife. I had three children, a boy 4 and twin daughters who were 6 months. And the telegram indicated there was no basis for an appeal. Just report for duty, be there pronto, and don't be late. Signed by a Colonel Grand Montaigne, who was commanding officer of the Pittsburgh Air Base at the time. We were in Coriopolis, Pennsylvania for about 3 or 4 days. We were sent to Greenville, South Carolina, to the Donelson Air Force Base there, which had been closed at the end of World War II. So we moved in, the first troops in, we had to reopen the base, and we were there for just about 6 months getting the base in operational condition. We were driving our own cars, we had no Jeeps, we had no military vehicles, we had one C-82 flying box, or we had one toolbox, we had no mess hall, we were eating in town, it was a mess, believe me. So then when the organization got activated, they brought the Cleveland troop carrier group in, who had a little bit more political pull through the Pentagon. They gobbled up most of our people. The 75th troop carrier was pretty well decimated at that point. They were sent to Japan, to Korea. I was very fortunate I didn't get much of a tour there. I spent most of my time in the States.
I see. Now, you went down there as a unit, as a reserve unit?
Reserve unit, yes.
Out of Pittsburgh?
Yes.
Now, you say you didn't go to, did you go to Japan at
no,
all?
No, I missed that tour. I was very fortunate that way.
I see. What did you do here in the States?
We kept the airplanes that we were getting in. They were very badly beat up C-82 flying boxcar. We were getting them ready for troops who were going overseas.
The people in the unit did get sent to Japan.
Some of them got picked for the tour in Japan and also into Korea.
What did they do over there?
They were flying in supplies to the, or parachuting supplies into the armed forces, the Marines who were fighting the battle, as well as dropping paratroopers in certain areas.
I see.
And then they were shuttling troops in back and forth between the States and Japan and Korea.
Uh-huh. So you returned back to Youngstown at the conclusion of your...
Our tour, yeah.
Your tour. Did your family stay right here in Youngstown?
They stayed. I have never had my family with me in the military because it was always too uncertain. I only had them with me once when I was up at Grand Tool, Illinois, and we was only there for 3 months, and we came home.
I see. Could you just give me a little bit more background on some of the happenings, day-by-day events of your training here at Youngstown when the unit flew out of the municipal airport before there was any real Air Force base up there? What did you do when you went to drill? And how often? And all that?
We were very fortunate. We had a man up there by the name of Major Altair. Major Altair was a P-40 pilot in China, and he flew fighter cover for my outfit when I was over there. I knew Major Fred Altair quite well. He was a career flying officer, fantastic command officer. And he took over up at the base, he and Captain Barnhart, and they ran a pretty tight ship up there. And it was strictly like being right back in the service for one weekend.
I see.
You report up there in full uniform. You had drills. Basically, our main thing there was flying, keeping the airplanes going. And they would have cross-country flights. They would put on exhibition flights for the people here. The mechanics worked in the planes, kept the planes flying, kept them clean. So it was really just like being back on active duty for a weekend.
I see. Now, did you stay up there like overnight or anything?
No, we came home because they had no facilities there.
Where did you eat?
Anywhere you could find a restaurant. They had no mess facilities there at the time, and a lot of time fellows would carry their lunches up just to be there for the whole day.
I see.
Come home at night.
Did you get paid for this?
Yes, we got paid. I forget what it amounted to over a year's time. But when we were recalled to Korea, we were told, hey, you know what you're getting into. You're being paid for it. You asked for it. So take your pill and swallow it and go off to war. As simple as that. And it was true.
Uh-huh. Now, you were studying at Youngstown College at the time?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You were going to be a lawyer? Or?
I had hopes of becoming a lawyer, but I got pulled away for 18 months, and I broke up the continuity of school. I came home. I got a job with the company for whom I am now working, and I've been able to study on the side before I need, my law work here in the work with the insurance company.
I see. Now, you, who do you work for now?
I work for the Commercial Union Insurance Company, which is a British-based insurance company out of London, England. We are the largest insurance company in the world.
I see.
And I supervise the claim office here in Youngstown territory for that company.
I see. Now, you indicated that your wife, or your family, excuse me, didn't really look forward to you being in the military. You would have gotten out of the military?
I wanted to stay.
I see.
In fact, when the Vietnam conflict came up, I had written a letter to the War Department hoping that they might have something for me to do. I was very politely thanked for my letter, but advised that they had sufficient people, and I think what they were telling me was I was just a little bit too old to get back in.
What do you hold this fondness for the military, or your desire to serve active duty time for with?
Well, once I think it's not a duty, it's an honor to me to serve in the military, and I think I got this bug when I was in high school at South High School here in Youngstown. I had a history teacher whose name was Miss Jean Fry, and she was president at that time of the DAR, and I had her in my senior year for American history.
Mm-hmm.
And she made me feel so proud to be an American, and she made me feel so proud to be here and to have all these benefits, and she made me realize that this country was something that just wasn't given to you on the platter. You had to, you know, to make sacrifices to protect what you had. So when I got out of high school, I was just so imbued with this military thing that I just, when the first chance came, I went into it.
I see.
And I did find out that the men there, the fellows in the military, in my estimation, the fellowship, the comradeship, is something you can't find in the civilian life. And I think the military man, in my estimation, is a tremendous guy. His dedication, his honesty. Granted, there's a lot of characters in the service, but I think the overall military picture, in my estimation, is important to the country, and I'm proud to be a part of it.
You mentioned the camaraderie and the friendship. You don't think that there's any other organizations or anything in America today that could rival the military establishment?
Not in my estimation. I don't think there are. I've been in a lot of organizations in my lifetime. I've been active in many, many things, but I still keep coming back to the military. That's why I'm active in the Coast Guard program now. I was out of the Air Force for a few years, and I had a chance to get into the Coast Guard program 10 years ago, and I get into it, and I'm still in it, and I love it.
What is your... what do you do in the Coast Guard now?
Well, right now, I am... attached here in Youngstown with the Coast Guard Auxiliary, which is a civilian component of the Coast Guard. We spend our summers on the local inland lakes and on the Great Lakes, checking boats for safety, licensing, enforcing the requirements of the boating equipment. Wintertime, we conduct classes for the public, and we put on talks to different groups, Boy Scouts. And basically, our whole program is safe boating for the pleasure boater.
Getting back to this reserve in Vienna, you say that you didn't use any runways, or what was the runway situation up there?
We had a big grassy field up there which we were allowed to use. The runway was strictly at that time for the commercial planes.
Uh-huh.
We used the grassy runway right opposite our tent up there, which was the headquarters at that time. Later on, we were able to move into one room inside the old established terminal at the time. One room, one desk, one chair for the colonel, and that was about the extent of the operation at the time.
Everybody else had to stand up.
Stand around and talk.
What type of plane, would you go over that one a little bit for me?
They had what was known then as it was a North American Texan AT-6A, advanced trainer, which was probably one of the finest airplanes ever made. And it was strictly a two-seater trainer plane, single engine, had retractable landing gears, and had all the capability of a fighter plane.
I see. Now, you being a bomber pilot, per se, how did you fit into this?
Real easy, because you go through these single-engine craft before you go into the multi-engine airplanes, so you work up through so it wasn't much of a transition back to the smaller planes.
So, really, while you were here prior to going back down to Pittsburgh, that's all you did fly?
Yeah.
Now, when you returned to Pittsburgh, was this unit disestablished up here? Is that it, or
no? It wasn't disestablished. It was more or less broken up into smaller units. And so they sent part of our unit down to the Greater Pittsburgh Airport, and the rest of us stayed up here, and they're the ones who were the nucleus of the present base at this time.
I see. Now, why did you particularly go back down to Pittsburgh?
I was just asked by Major Altier one time if I'd like to go. And I said, yes, I never questioned it. Because being a military man, you never question an order or a request, which many times is an order. Mm-hmm. So I took the chance, because Pittsburgh was a bigger, they had a huge National Guard Air Force outfit there at the time. They had much more in the way of facilities, and they were building the Greater Pittsburgh Airport, which is now the Pittsburgh Airport. There was much more to do there, much more facilities. They had mess halls, they had more airplanes, more mechanics, more everything.
I see. Now, you down there, you say you flew the C-82
box. Fairchild flying boxcars.
Did this take any training, any retraining for you at all, or did you just fit into that one too?
These guys, the American pilot or the American, any of the American military men in my estimation can step in anywhere and take over anything without much training. To me, they're just tremendous.
There wasn't any training program for you?
It was all training. Everything there was training.
Right. But I mean, there wasn't any formal school you went
to? No. Well, they had classroom sessions. They had skull sessions down there, and you could sit around talking. But a lot of the fellows who had only been out of the service for a short while were still very capable flyers.
I see. Now, did you ever fly on your own after this period?
Yeah, I came back. I belonged to a flying club here. Five of us had a little Taylor Cub, and I've flown recently. My brother-in-law, Bill Lydon, the Lydon Oil Company, has got his own corporation plane, which I've had a chance to fly. It's a turbojet, but it's not the same as flying back World War II. That was a little different situation. It seemed was more fun.
More flying by the seat of your pants.
Flying by the seat of your pants, yeah.
I think I heard that one before.
Yeah.
The training that you did receive, in other words, were you supposed to be combat ready to go?
Oh, yes. Yeah, the Air Force is always combat ready. In fact, we were the only activated reserve outfit in the country when the Korean War broke. That's why we were grabbed up so quickly. We were combat ready right then.
Now, how did you maintain your qualifications? Did you have to fly so many hours?
Well, there was no... We flew many hours. In fact, a flyer will fly any chance he gets. They're kind of crazy people. But you had to be out there every weekend. That was a requirement. You didn't miss your weekends. You had your drill sessions to be there, and you better have a good excuse why you couldn't be there, or there'd be someone knocking on your door.
Now, that was one weekend a month.
One weekend a month, yeah. But well, I was out there. Most of the fellows were out there every weekend, just for the idea of having some place to go, being back around the planes, being with your buddies again. So it wasn't a matter of begging guys to come out or fighting the crowd. They were there. There was always men out there in an overabundance every Sunday and every Saturday.
I'm sure this didn't endear this to the family either.
No, I was. I had lunch with Captain Barnhart Wednesday of this past week, and when he was coming out of the service in World War II, he had applied for a job with United Airlines, and he was in Colorado at the time. His wife was in Florida, so he sent her a letter. Said that he was coming out of the service, but he had this job with United Airlines, and he was going to take this job at $450 a month in those days, which was big money for anybody. He got a letter back from his wife saying, "Dear Jack, you have your choice, them or us." Signed, love in his wife's name. So he went back to Florida. He gave up his job of flying for the airlines.
Did when everybody was called back to the Korean situation, was there much hard feeling about going back?
Yeah, there was. Actually, those of us who got called back were fellows who were either in school, getting our education, or getting started in a new job, or getting started in the job that you'd left. They had new wives, young families. We were down in Greenville, South Carolina, with our wives and kids back home, and here's these other high school kids and college kids with their convertibles and their girlfriends running around having a ball. We're sitting down here in this Donaldson Air Force Base, which was really a dump at the time. At that time, we were thinking it was more of a war of economics to keep our economics up than really a war of necessity. Mm-hmm. And then when they stopped MacArthur at the 30th parallel, then we really were mad. We felt we were moving. We felt we should have gone all the way up to Manchuria.
Do you think that
your being assigned down there at Donelson didn't help any. In other words, if you'd have been sent to combat or...
Yeah, I think so. Practically all the men there were combat veterans. In fact, on our first day, we had our big parade for a visiting general. When these men walked down this ramp with the new Air Force blue uniforms on, all the ribbons, it was amazing the number of men there. There wasn't one man there who didn't have at least two rows of ribbons on his tunic. These were combat veterans. And I think if they could have all gone over as a unit to Korea as one unit, I think there had been a much more higher esprit de corps.
Definitely there wasn't the esprit de corps
during World War II. No, the morale was relatively low, I found. There was a lot of griping, a lot of complaining. Fellows didn't know why they had to be there. They felt that Korea was, I suppose, comparable to what Vietnam was to this generation.
I see. Now, in your experience with the reserves here in Youngstown, do you think they foresaw something like this? In other words, if they could have foreseen a call-up or something, they'd have been so anxious to participate?
This is what was amazing. This was a good question, because every guy out there who went into the reserve program had been anywhere from 4 to 5 years in World War II. And looking back over history, we all figured, well, there won't be another war for 20 years, so we'll stay in, keep our rank, get our pay, get our flying in, have our weekends with the fellows. We never anticipated almost 5 years today we would be back into another world conflict. And I think we were all shocked by the fact that we could be into a war that quick. And I know I was myself. I was amazed, because I thought, well, there won't be another war for at least 20 years. And I think that's what kind of shook the fellows up. They were more or less lulled into a sense of false security, thinking, well, now we haven't made, we've been through one war. Now we can stay in reserves, build up our ratings, our ranks, our time, and then look for a retirement program.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of the fellows, when they did come back from the Korean service, quit the reserve program. They were very disgruntled.
Now, looking back on it now, do you think you could have possibly, or you would have stayed in the reserve program?
This is the thing about history that I always admire. You can look back on things when they're over, and you can see all the good things and all the good bad things about it. I've spent, since I came out of the service, I spent all this time researching the entire war in the Pacific. And when you put it all together, one big picture, it looks real, real nice. I think now I look back on Korea, I think I know why we were there. I think I know why we had to be there. I don't know why we were stopped at the 38th parallel, other than a political motivation. But I think now I look back over it, if I could do it again, I would have probably stayed. I see now, we're right now, since the communist threat is so great, I think more than ever, I think our military should be built up, should be strong.
What do you foresee for the Navy, the Air Force Reserve in the future? Do you think it's
after having read the World War II naval history in the Pacific, I've had to change a lot of thinking. Of course, my wife is irritated at the fact she doesn't know. She thinks I'm a traitor to the Air Force because I've swung over heavily to the naval aspect of it. I think myself, the Navy is really our front line of defense. I think we need a strong Navy. I think we need a big Navy. We need a modern Navy, because I'm sure that that's where the bulk of the battle will be fought. This time will be on the water.
Do you think the Air Force plays a role?
Oh yes, yeah. I think the Air Force is going to play a big role, but I still think the Navy is in my estimation is the number one thing today.
Do you think there's any chance of a conflict between the superpowers?
I think it's possible. I think it's quite possible. I think they'll hold off as long as they can.
Uh-huh.
But I think that if the wrong person gets panicky and pushes the wrong button, I think we're going to be in big trouble. I know recently Nixon made the remark to somebody that he had the power. He could walk into a room and push the button, he says, and have the whole world in complete under his thumb. And he's right. So if you get a man in there with a sick mind that's going to push that button, why, we could be in real big trouble.
Is there anything I haven't asked you anything tonight, Mr. Addington?
No, I think you've done a very good job of interrogation. I think you're a typical naval officer.
We always like to try to get the views and opinions on the world situation in our interviews, and that's why
I do think one thing, I think the American nation, of course, we are not a military nation, and that's something we have to understand. I'm a unique person, and I think military all the time. I don't know why I grew up with it in such a way. I've adapted to it quite well. But I think this nation has got the wrong outlook on the military. I don't think we give them enough of the moral support that they should have. And I think the people as a whole don't even consider the military as even being a part of our way of life. And I think it is. And I would like to see a compulsory military program in our high school or even in our colleges. I really would. Not to be a dictatorial type person, but I think myself, I think a strong nation will be one that Russia will look at twice before she makes a move on.
There's one last question I wanted to ask you before we stop the tape or anything. Is if you had any special story that most guys in the military have a sea story or a story of such nature that they kind of like to relate. Like to send one down or put one down for posterity's sake.
One of my favorite stories, I still correspond with Madam Chiang Kai-shek. She's a very, very dear friend of mine, a very dear lady, very gracious lady. In fact, I would call her an elegant lady. And when we had arrived at Kunming, China, with our planes, they had never seen a bomber quite this close. This was a new bomber. So we were down on the line checking with our Chinese mechanics and our American mechanics there. And I'm standing with a couple other fellas. And I saw this beautiful woman walking down the line looking at the airplanes. Well, being a typical young, smart American GI, I said, my God, guys, look at that good-looking Chinese broad coming down here. And she was beautiful. She had on one of these high-necked, black satin Chinese gown with a split side on. You can see part of her thigh, you know. Very lovely lady. She walked by and smiled and nodded and kept on going. Well, that night, the Generalissimo had a banquet to welcome us to China, make us feel welcome at home. And sitting up on the podium beside the Generalissimo was this good-looking Chinese brother I'd made the pun about. So she gets up to make her welcoming speech, and I begin sliding down in my chair, embarrassed, thinking, well, here comes the axe. And she says, gentlemen, she says, today I had one of the finest compliments ever paid me, a Chinese woman. One of your group called me a good-looking Chinese broad. That's it. And so everyone applauded, and she says, because in China, she says, men don't tell their women that. And she says, I was delighted and honored, and she says, it was the biggest day of my life. So I thought, well, see, I wasn't so stupid after all.
Well, thank you, Mr. Angle.
My pleasure.
For the interview.
It was fun.